Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. Today we will be speaking with Susan Myrick about two topics, the first segment of which will be about voter fraud in New Hampshire and what's going on in that state to combat it, and she will have on a special guest for that segment. Make sure you check out who it is. Then we will speak with Demi Dowdy about what different faith-based groups are doing for the hurricane relief effort. You will not want to miss that segment. And then we'll catch another segment with Susan Myrick talking about how unaffiliated voters have now surpassed the Republican Party, the number of registered Republican voters in the state. And while it is the Republicans who are passed, it is the Democrats who are hemorrhaging voters. Now we get right into our first segment with Susan Myrick.
Today we're going to go outside of North Carolina to look at how another state has been attacking voter fraud. North Carolina had a few good years from 2011 to 2013. The legislature attempted to change election law, but any major reforms have been overturned in the courts, and now, unfortunately, the legislature seems to be worn down, and they don't want to even entertain new voter ID or an elimination of a same-day registration law. That's not the case in New Hampshire, where things appear to be changing along with the election of a new governor. There's a man in New Hampshire that is at the forefront of voter fraud investigations in the state. His name is Ed Nail, and he is on the phone today with us. He's chairman of the Coalition of New Hampshire Taxpayers. He's investigated and documented voter fraud for decades, and he's even worked with James O'Keefe to expose fraud and corruption in elections. Tell us about New Hampshire. Tell us about something that I had never heard of before. I talked to you several years ago for the first time, something called voter fraud nests.
Yeah, New Hampshire is a very small state, and we entertain the presidential primary here every 2 years, because they start 2 years before the primary. People will start announcing and sneaking through New Hampshire to get a feel of the place and trying to make some friends if they're going to run for president. And I'm one of those contacts from, let's say, the conservative side that comes through here. So we're well aware of what goes on and who's who. It's such, there's only a 1.3 million people in the whole state, although we have over 1 million people registered to vote. And when you have 200,000 kids in school, it comes real close to being 100% voter registration. But what happens here is we don't have a public way of getting a hold of the statewide database. The HAVA came through in 2002, and we had to create the statewide database, but it's been restricted to
primary candidates, PACs,
and the parties. So if you're running for governor, you get to see the whole statewide database. If you're running for a House seat in one district, you only get to see that district. So for us to track voter fraud, all we get really is some large numbers now and then. And what makes me suspicious here in New Hampshire is the amount of people who are registered to vote as opposed to the people that live here. And the large differences in people registering to vote and people disappearing from the rolls. Now, recently we had Speaker of the House, Sean Jasper, requested the Secretary of State to try and settle this and maybe get some information out for the legislature to quiet down some of the accusations of voter fraud. And he got a response from the Secretary of State, who ran some voters' names through the Department of Safety, which would be your DMV, I guess, there, the Department of Safety, and came up with over 6,000 people had registered to vote, and not between then and August 16th of 2017, gotten a driver's license or registered a car.
That's required under
state statute,
what you're
under
saying,
motor vehicle laws. You have to 60
right.
days to, if you move here, to register your car and your vehicles that are going to stay in the state.
So, Ed, what you're saying is your Speaker of the House actually went and asked for this data to get you guys to shut up, to finally put an end to the talks of voter fraud. And what he got,
I think that's it. Yeah,
surprised him.
Speaker Jasper was elected by Democrat votes. So he's, he's not really that interested in discovering voter fraud from my interactions with him over the years, and it's been a long time. So I think he was just trying to settle this and be over with, and maybe a handful of numbers. Well, what we got was the 6,000 numbers, but if you look closely, the Secretary of State only used November 8th, the day of the general election in 2016. That's the only numbers he sent in. And we have a lot of people register same day. So what I'm thinking is, when you look at the Secretary of State's website with the amount of people who get on and get off the rolls, we had, after between November 8th, that's the general election, and December 28th, over 19,000 people removed from the rolls, the voter rolls, on the statewide database that I can't see. Now, right after an election, our election officials are like one-armed paper hangers trying to put all the same-day registrants in their town that walk in and say, hi, I want to vote today, I have no ID, take my picture and I'll swear that I am who I am and I'll disappear. All those names and the addresses that are given have to be entered into the statewide database. And when you ask for information after an election, they say, oh, we won't be finished till March, maybe April. But somehow they managed to get 19,000 people off the rolls. And I'd like to know, maybe we should check those 19,000 people. You know, if Sean Jasper, the Speaker of the House, wants to know how many people are running around the state of New Hampshire voting and don't have a driver's license or never were domiciled here, wouldn't it be nice to add those? And the other suspicious number is, between December 28th and 2015 and our February 9th presidential primary here in New Hampshire of 2016, 72,000 people got on the rolls. That's 1,400 a day.
Wow.
Even with all of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders people stomping the bushes, it's hard to get that many people to register to vote every day.
Sure.
So I'd like to see, maybe we should have the Secretary of State review those numbers. And instead of just the people who registered same day and on election day on November 8th, and that was a couple thousand maybe, but instead of doing that, let's do the whole package and get a really good glimpse of where New Hampshire is. While the Trump Election Integrity Commission is still functioning, this is a golden opportunity to review what exactly is happening in New Hampshire, just not taking a little pinprick of a look at one day of the year.
Well, we're fortunate in North Carolina, I must say. The one thing we're fortunate in is that we do have access to our voter rolls. I can go right now and pull out all the people who registered or who are registered to vote. Are you telling me, yeah, of those 19,000 people removed in that short period of time, would you be able to get a list of those people from the Board of Elections or your?
No way.
No. No. Wow.
No, no, almost nothing is public information anymore. The more I pry into this, the more they seem to make public documents disappear. It has gotten so bad that I went out to Keene, which is a college town, a year ago, and I asked for their city list of voters. And it used to be $36 or $40 or something. I had about $60-$70 on me. They said, well, it's $125. Wow. And I said, what? I just bought it for $35 or whatever. And she said, well, that's orders from the Secretary of State's office. We have to charge $125 for the whole city. I said, all right, so I'll come back. I drove home 45 minutes, and I drove back 45 minutes to Keene. And they said, do you have that form that we gave you to fill out to request the Keene voter checklist? I said, yeah. And I handed it to them. They took it. They said, you're not allowed to have that. That's a private, that's not a public document. I said, what? I said, a document I signed my name to isn't a public document to me? And they said, well, that's orders from the Secretary of State's
office. So had they called the Secretary of State while you were gone?
Yeah, go ahead.
Had they called the Secretary of State while you were gone and were ready for you when you came back?
I don't know, but I know they're suspicious of me.
Right.
In Keene, years ago, I went in and I would ask for the voter registration card from a voter and give the name. And they'd say, well, here it is. And I said, now, can I have the other one? Because his name is on the checklist twice. And they, so they're very careful how they answer me. So, but to have the application to purchase the city's voter checklist not be a public document, you're getting down into the weeds here, yeah, of not letting somebody like myself get a hold of these documents. I would be able to tell who else purchased if I said I'd like to request a copy of the names of all the individuals who bought the City of Keene's checklist. And if they gave them to me, I could decipher who was buying them,
right,
and what organizations they were with or something like that. But to hide that, I mean, that's really pathetic. And I haven't seen that in state law. It was the officials there. I have to go back with an official right to know request to be denied in writing. And then I have that to pursue. I can take them to court and try and get it or take it to state representatives. I was at a meeting yesterday. There must have been 25 state representatives there, a couple senators. And they're very keen on tightening up some of these laws. So I got to talk to a couple of them that I'm going to send some emails to, and we'll chat about making things public. But one was horrified that I could not get my hands on the statewide database, which here in New Hampshire, I just send an email to the state of Vermont, and once a month, they send me their statewide database for nothing. It's updated. So when I want to track Vermont voters here in New Hampshire, I have the statewide database from Vermont. Connecticut's is public. I can check them in Connecticut, and I get some sort of a voter history occasionally.
And I can't imagine what you could do if you had that New Hampshire database. I think you would break it wide open if you had a chance at it. Let me ask you to tell our North Carolina listeners what voter fraud nests are. I don't think they've ever heard of this term before.
The
voter nests that the people who
Here in New Hampshire, we have different locations where people from out of state can come and safely vote and work on campaigns. And we caught one. There's a state senator named Martha Fuller Clark, and she had probably eight people at her home in Portsmouth. She has a million-dollar home in Portsmouth in the historic district. And a couple of years back, somebody checked, and they gave me the information that she had up to eight people living there that weren't direct relatives or were actually living somewhere else. And we checked on them, and I'll give you one example. One guy's name is Brian Gregory Griffith, and he's an attorney from Arkansas. So Brian got caught. I mean, he voted here, and we got the name, and we did a little background search on him. Well, Arkansas has a statewide income tax. So what this guy is saying is when the AG went to investigate the eight people, they investigated Brian Gregory Griffith and said, well, you know, he had established a presence at this location. Well, our Constitution says you have to establish a domicile, various laws say you have to establish a domicile, not a residence, a domicile. That's the specific. So we use that as an example to expose these different locations. She's been having people admitted, having people there for years, stay at her house and work on campaigns. Well, staying at the house and working on a campaign is not establishing a residence, a domicile, a home. You're there temporarily, and the city of Portsmouth has rules against letting people stay at your house or renting out rooms. So if they're not paying, they're staying there for nothing. It's a voter fraud nest. We caught one at 1200 Elm Street. There were dozens and dozens of people over the years of multiple campaigns working for Obama and Clinton and whatnot. And an example would be we caught, I think, a woman named Caitlin Ann Legocki. She was here in 2008 working for Jean Shaheen. And then in 2010, she was in your state working for Senator Hagan.
Senator Hagan.
Hagan. In 2012, she was working for Claire McCaskill, Senator McCaskill, and she voted in Missouri on whatever date it was in 2012. And her name was checked off on the voter list here in New Hampshire because in 2008, she had stayed at 1200 Elm Street with a group of other people who were working on campaigns. Since her name was never taken off the voter checklist, anybody can walk in and check off her name. So because I can't get a hold of I can't go through the statewide database and confirm things like this, I would have to go town to town to town. It's another big problem, but that was a nest. And once we started to expose that nest and the other one on the radio, the one at State Senator's house and the one at 1200 Elm, the city clerk in Manchester, God bless him, purged the voter list of his city right after we exposed that. He sent out 8,000 some odd letters to people who hadn't voted in two election cycles, and he got 4,400 back as undeliverable.
Wow.
Now, that's a large number of these individuals
that had been here and
were left open on the rolls. Of the 8,000 letters he sent out, only 103 people responded in writing saying, yes, I want to stay on the voter checklist.
Wow.
So that's the wide disparity in numbers you see in New Hampshire. And it's never going to get corrected until they release the statewide database to the public for us to review. And every mom and pop and people in their pajamas can point this out.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's talk about something else that we have in common. Every once in a while, you'll come across people that have been through North Carolina before, and one of those people is Carl Robert Gibson. I think he was arrested in North Carolina at a Moral Monday protest.
Yes.
In 2013, I think.
Oh, yeah. Carl's one of our best catches. Carl was here in New Hampshire in 2008 and 2012. When he got arrested in 2012, he got arrested. There was a special election for a House seat, and it was a young lady named Yvonne Dean Bailey running for that seat. She was a college student. And he came with, I think, Credo Pack might have been who was paying it, but he came here to work against this young lady and for the hardcore left-wing candidate that was running for this House seat. So he was using every dirty trick he could. So what he did was he made up an email similar to hers and sent it to the newspapers and said she was withdrawing from the race on, the Thursday before the election. And that would lessen the turnout if people thought, oh, Yvonne Dean Bailey dropped out. So a reporter from the Concord Monitor alerted the AG's office, and they arrested him. And they catch him, at his little apartment in Concord. Now, he had multiple places to live. When they arrested him, he had a driver's license from Kentucky. His car was registered in Connecticut. He had a home he voted from in Madison, Wisconsin, a commune for activists. He had the place here in New Hampshire. And his license was his parents' home in Kentucky. So once we got him, I said, oh, man, I actually have a name, a birth date, and a voting record here in New Hampshire. We set upon him. And his life has not been the same ever since. When he got arrested, they said that the arraignment was going to be at Merrimack District Court, not far from my house. So I went down there and sat down next to someone I assumed would be maybe his lawyer. And a couple of minutes later, in waddled Carl Robert Gibson, sat down with his attorney. We were brushing up against each other, and I heard the two of them plan out his defense and what would happen and what he could expect. And I ran outside, and I called our bloggers that have a little radio program, and I told them to post it, what I had heard. And I believe we had that on the radio and the blogs before he ever got to see the judge. And we've been tangled with each other ever since. He's still, I think he appealed his case to the Supreme Court and may still be stuck there. We haven't spent much time with him. But he would get arrested all around the country. Like, he was an early Antifa type person.
Right.
He would get arrested for refusal to leave an area. And what he did was he held up a picture of his Kentucky, arrest in one of the states. And it had his Kentucky driver's license number on it. And I got the number, and I checked with Kentucky, and it was still a valid license. He'd renewed it in a period of time when he'd been voting. So we use him as a shining example of the creeps that come to New Hampshire and stalk our state looking for votes and to do harm and to mess around with campaigns. Carl Robert Gibson, if you look up his name on the Internet, Carl Robert Gibson, you'll see dozens of articles we've written about him. And there's nothing he can do about it. He kind of has to sit back and suffer the consequences. Because he's guilty.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. I've got a couple other nests. And some of these nests, you find people who work for NGP Van. That's the big database that Democrats run. You link these together, and all of a sudden, as you take a couple of steps up the voter fraud ladder, you get into the higher echelon of these fraudsters and political activists that come here and don't follow the law. And that's who we're after now. So associating myself with Civitas, guys like you, I can call up and get some information. We both now know about Gibson and other states that I talked to as well. So this is a nice thing about this. Every time one state makes a gain, North Carolina makes a gain, New Hampshire makes a gain, California is really bad. If things break loose in California and we can fix election laws there, the rest of the country is going to be a lot better off.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yep.
I tell you, and there's one other thing that is alike for North Carolina and New Hampshire, but different in that same day registration. I think in New Hampshire, you just have same day registration on one day, right?
Same day registration, the day of the election.
The day of the election, where we have same day registration, not on the day of the election, but 2.5 weeks ahead of election day during our early voting period, people can mm-hmm. come and register and vote and disappear, which is what they do. After they vote with minimal, they call it ID, but it's not. It's a utility bill or something like that, which is ridiculous. But I know New Hampshire is alike in this too. The left in New Hampshire has to say there is no voter fraud, just like the left in North Carolina says there is no voter fraud. You're so inspirational because this isn't your life. This isn't what you do for a living. You spend a lot of your life doing the work that needs to be done to show some type of integrity in elections. But I did find out something, which you alluded to just a minute ago, about you yesterday that I didn't know, and that you call yourself a lumberjack, right? By trade? Yep.
Basically, this New Hampshire's full of trees, you know, so I have a lot of customers.
I think that's fascinating.
I work for Steel Timber Sports, and we occasionally come down to North Carolina for events.
Well, call us when you're here, because from what I have read in articles about you, you're one of the best there is when it comes to chainsaws. So I appreciate so much you coming to talk to us today. Like I said, I think you are an inspiration. I think the people of North Carolina need a shot in the arm. They've gone through some disappointing times in the attempt to reform our elections, but we've still got some fight left in us, and I hope we can take that inspiration from you and move forward. So thank you so much, Ed.
Thanks a lot.
How you doing, Demi? Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me back.
So you are bringing the topic to us today about hurricane relief, but not just hurricane relief, specifically certain groups. So what is that about?
Right. So USA Today recently did an article that just came out this week about how faith groups have been taking the lead in disaster relief in the wake of hurricanes Irma and Harvey, and also I wrote also about hurricane recovery that is still ongoing from Matthew in our own state and how faith groups have taken the lead in that as well.
Right, and that's an interesting point talking about Hurricane Matthew as well, because a lot of people forget, you know, we're over a year or about a year or whatever after Matthew. There's still a lot of effects in the state.
Yeah, there are a lot of effects in the state. And what's most interesting to me is that Governor Cooper recently issued a press release announcing that there were going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants given to organizations aiding in that recovery. And the vast majority of that was given to faith groups.
Right. So why is this so important? Why is it faith groups are the ones that are worth talking about?
Well, because it's counterintuitive to what the left would like to say is most effective, right? So the left would constantly argue that we should spend millions in government funds to government organizations to solve problems like the problems that we've seen, the disaster that we've seen in the wake of these natural disasters. But what's interesting is that even the leftist media is finally admitting that faith groups are actually more effective than the government at solving these issues.
Right, and they're also not just maybe more efficient with their dollars, but they're quicker in a lot of ways, aren't they?
They are. They're quicker. They are more effective. Somehow, it's always less expensive to give money directly to these more effective religious organizations that go right to where the problems are, and they actually help people.
Right. It's kind of, you know, how much of your dollar makes it through from donation or, in the case of a state dollar, taxation.
That's right.
To the cause. You know, is it 80 cents in the dollar, 90 cents in the dollar? And how much of it makes it through the government machine to get to that purpose versus if you give it to a faith group?
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting, Matt, is when you think about what motivates government entities and the individuals in the government. And unfortunately, because we're human, and it's often power, right? And so if you look at faith groups, they ideally are motivated by the common good, by a motivation for helping their brother or sister, getting in their community and making a real impact.
Right. And I grew up as a church kid, and we had the mission trips we went on in the summer. But I remember Hurricane Katrina, and they were putting together teams and buckets and sending teams and buckets down days after the storm. I mean, water had just receded or was receding in areas still, and there were people from my church down there. And then that summer, we went to Mississippi for the senior high
mission trip. We went to Mississippi, and we were there helping out with recovery efforts. And I mean, it was, and this was one church, and how many churches in the Southeast or in the country went to those same areas?
Yeah, thankfully, North Carolina was not as affected as we thought we would be by these hurricanes in the last couple of months. But unfortunately, there are a lot of other areas in our country that have been, and it's been very tragic. But you have seen, I've seen at least, a lot of North Carolina churches and religious organizations immediately step up, start Facebook groups, start working and collecting donations and just driving down and helping out and pitching in. And that's because they're not waiting to get paid to do that. They're just doing it. And so we know that they are most effective at actually helping, not just saying they're going to help, not just coming up with a plan or having a government organization declare that aid is on its way. They're doing the work.
Right. And I mean, that's the difference in, you know, great intentions and great plans versus action and getting there on the ground, being there. Mm-hmm. And people not just being there, but people who are here, church groups to receive, people who have evacuated. I mean, there's this whole, a lot of different things that can be done in that sphere that are being picked up. The bills being picked up by church groups. The job is being picked up by a lot of these faith groups.
Yeah, and you know, I do think it goes back to what I said earlier about motivation. What is their motivation? And if you are a person of faith, and I am, then you believe that the Bible mandates that you treat others as you would want to be treated, that you love others as God loves you, and that you come to the aid of widows and orphans in their time of need, right? So these are very specific things that Christians are told in the Bible that are mandates. And so if you're a person of faith and you believe those things to be true, that is what motivates you, not a dollar amount. And so I believe that is why religious organizations are most effective at getting these jobs done.
Definitely. And so what else on this topic?
So I guess I already mentioned here in North Carolina that Governor Cooper has issued grants to religious organizations in the state for ongoing relief from Hurricane Matthew effects. So I'd love your thoughts on this, too. You know, he was the one who was complaining about the money that was initially promised to the state from the federal government, not like President Trump said they wouldn't follow through with that. But what Cooper's actually doing is sending money to religious organizations. So,
right. And he recognizes the good infrastructure already in that system to get stuff done, to get things done with that money.
Right.
Is the way it kind of comes off to me when you're talking about it, saying, okay, so the state, does the state have the power to go in and do these things? Yes, mm-hmm. The state has the power to go in and do all these different things. But to recognize that that money would be put to good use by these groups says a lot.
It does. It does. And it's really wild that twice the amount of money that was given to other groups were given to religious organizations. I mean, double the amount of money, because he knows and he can admit through the dollar that that is most effective.
And that's a good thing. That's a good thing that he's able to see past and do that.
That's right. I think it's good to recognize that. I think it's interesting that the media is finally talking about this. And I think it's time that it not be ignored, that faith groups and religious groups are truly taking the lead. I think in the USA Today article, they said 80% of recovery efforts are being spearheaded by these faith groups. And that's an enormous impact. And I think you have to be able to say now that without those groups taking the lead, you know, we wouldn't be getting anywhere in recovery. And it kind of destroys the narrative of the left that the government is the invaluable ally of the citizen. Maybe we need to be looking locally to groups, not some national religious organizations as well, but especially local groups with religious and faith affiliations for help.
Right. And I mean, it just comes down to the people say, well, if the government doesn't do it, then who's going to do it?
Right.
And I think about in my community, and again, this is just my community or my church, and I go, well, there's the food bank that's supported by these various churches. There's these back to school efforts to get all these kids supplies. There's the right. overseas efforts. There's all these different sponsorships of people who are overseas in Africa. And,
yeah.
I mean, we're just my church and other, there's a dozen churches in town doing the same thing. And there's hundreds sure. in the county doing the same thing in the state, but are helping overseas locally in storm areas mm-hmm. in Russia and all these. And there's so many different efforts that are going on.
Right.
And you say, well, if the government's not going to do it, who is? And go 80% of the effort is from church groups. It's going to be the faith groups, because that is what right. the faith groups do.
Yeah. When you say, if not the government, then who? The reality is that they are doing much less of the work than these private organizations.
And that also gets into a whole conversation. I don't know if we want to go there, but about locking up money and taxation that mm-hmm. could be free to be given freely to
100%.
The faith organization of your choice. Right. How much more money could you give to your church, or I give to my church, or if this extra chunk of money was freed up?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting because several years ago when George W. Bush was president, I remember that there was all this protesting of the fact that he was giving all this new money. There was this new program to give religious organizations money to do aid all over the country. And these nonprofits with religious affiliations, not just Christian affiliations, but religious affiliations, suddenly had all this federal money. And there was this great protesting from the left. But how far have we come where now we recognize, you know, USA Today is writing an article about the fact that these religious organizations are the most effective at helping communities all over the country in the wake of disasters.
And they really are. But then again, that comes to the question of who do you want giving the money? Do you want the federal government taking the money, then giving it to the federal or the faith group? Or are you going to be the one to do it yourself? And again, that's another conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's a good follow up, though, because I would say the latter, and I'm sure you would too.
And I would.
But I think that he had a good start, at least.
Exactly. So. Oh yeah. And thanks for joining us today and talking
thanks,
about
Matt.
This. Is a very timely issue.
The blog is at nccivitas.org.
Yes, nccivitas.org to read what this conversation was about, and that's Demi Dowdy's post on nccivitas.org.
Thanks, Matt.
Are you a gun guy? Are you a gun girl? Do you know the difference between a clip and a magazine? Have you gotten into more arguments about 9mm, 40, and 45 than you care to admit? Then you need to go over to the Freedom Action Network and check out the NC Gun Dad Show, where we talk about guns, gear, accessories, and a whole lot more every week. I'm Matt Calder, and I was just another gun guy until the birth of my daughter. Then I became the NC Gun Dad. Join us weekly for a new episode of the NC Gun Dad Show, uploaded every Friday at www.freedomactionnetwork.com, and then click on the NC Gun Dad Show.
Susan, thanks for joining us again on What Matters in North Carolina. How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's good to be back.
Good, good. And we just came off of your segment about what's going on in another state as far as voter fraud, but you're here today to talk about a milestone of around voting of its own sorts in our state.
That's right, about voter registration. I was here a couple of weeks ago, probably maybe 2 months ago, talking about how the unaffiliated voter population was getting ready to overtake Republicans in numbers.
And I heard there's been some movement on that this week.
Absolutely. And actually, there's been movement for the last 8 weeks. And as of September 9th, Republicans are now behind the unaffiliated voter population by 55 voters.
So my voting group is taking over.
Your and my voting
my
group.
My unofficial our unofficial voting group is taking over.
That's exactly right. Let me give you some percentages, and I know this is dry stuff, but it's important. And what I said in the article that's on nccivitas.org is really, and while unaffiliated voters now outnumber Republicans, it's really not about the Republicans. I think it's about the Democrats and that party, because Republicans, while gaining voters, though not that many in the last 9 years, it's just over 50,000, it's the Democrats that have lost a significant, almost 300,000 voters.
And that's interesting, because when you first hear about it, you know, you think about it kind of like a race. and you go, okay, Republicans were in second place. Now they're in third place.
That's right.
So you think the Republicans lost a step, but you're saying it's actually, you know, the leader, Democrats, have been hemorrhaging voters, and they're ending up in the unaffiliated pool largely.
Absolutely. And while they've lost almost 300,000 voters, the unaffiliated ranks have gained almost 700,000 voters in the last 8 years. And that's amazing. And the way I look at it, in the next 4 years, very possibly, if the trend continues, and that's what I've been talking about since the first time I've actually looked at the trend, which was years ago, if the trend continues, which it picked up steam in the last 4 years before the 2016 election, the unaffiliated ranks will very possibly outnumber Democrats by 2020.
So, and that's amazing, but so what does this mean? What's driving this?
This is opinion of my own. I think what's driving this, there's a couple of things. Probably the major thing is the disaffected voter, the angry voter. They're looking at both parties pretty disgusted with both of them. I believe Democrats are leaving the people of North Carolina behind because they've become so radically leftist. They're no longer Democrats of past that could look even to a little bit of business sense. They've gone beyond that, and they're looking like the most radical elements outside of North Carolina. And Republicans, in some cases, just are not living up to their promises. And so I think what we're seeing is disaffected voters in the unaffiliated voter ranks. And I always have to say this, because North Carolina, it is a tenet of North Carolina's parties that they allow unaffiliated voters to vote in their primaries. So if I were an unaffiliated voter, which I am, during a primary, I could pick either the Democrat or the Republican ballot. So that does free up that voter. Why be affiliated with a party if you don't have to?
Right. So there is an incentive to do it. And you're talking about the voters being kind of disaffected.
Right.
But they're not disenfranchised to the point that they want to be out of the voting system. They still want to be voting, but they don't feel tied to a certain party.
Absolutely. That's it. That's the whole point. Why?
Right, because if it was just the unaffiliated, it's growing at a large rate, and Republicans were growing and Democrats were growing, it wouldn't signify this bleeding effect from one party.
Right.
But really, looking at the numbers, it sounds like the Democrats are hemorrhaging voters who are going to go into the unaffiliated side. And that's different from my situation, because from day one, I registered as an unaffiliated. I've always been an unaffiliated. I didn't particularly want to identify and be identified with either party, and that was a decision I made from day one. But that's not, I guess, a large chunk of the 700,000 voter growth, is it?
Well, some people are claiming that it is. It's younger voters just not choosing a party. But I think it's obvious with the amount of voters that the Democrats are losing, that's not it.
Right. It's not people dying and going off the voter rolls.
No.
It's not people
moving
away.
Out of state. That's right. It's not that at all. It is truly a concerted effort, a decision being made by the individual voter. When you think about Democrats, I think it was back in 2009 when they made up over 50% or close to 50% of the voter rolls, and now they're down to 38%. That's just shocking.
That's a very significant difference.
And on top of everything, they're losing. At least they did in 2016, they did in 2014, they did in 2012 and 2010. Since 2010, the Republicans have taken over the legislature. They're now the majority in the Council of States, and they've got the lieutenant governor's office. And, of course, we know that there's a big difference in congressional districts. So, there's a problem.
Right, and so playing devil's advocate, really, or at least bringing that point up, people would say that the whole gerrymandering issue is the reason why, but it doesn't hold water when you look back at when the Republicans originally took power in the state. Those were under Democrat districts.
That's right.
And the congressional and state level.
That's right.
So that argument doesn't really hold water. There is a real push. You can say that maybe the amount of the lead could be affected by the way districts are drawn now, but looking back 7 years ago, when the original push to power came for the Republicans, that was playing by the Democrats' rules.
That's exactly right, in districts that the Democrats drew. And also we're seeing around the state that county commissioner districts are being taken over by Republicans. We also saw in 2016, when you look at the number of votes gotten or received by each legislative district, Republicans won out on that number, almost 52-48. So the state has really done a flip-flop when it comes to voting. Of course, Democrats still outnumber Republicans and unaffiliated, but I dare say in the next 4 or 5 years that may change.
And that'll be another huge shift for sure. I mean, if unaffiliateds become the largest voting bloc in the state, my question is it time for another party? Is it time for maybe a more formalized independent party, something?
But you know, Matt, and I understand what you're saying, but these voters have a ideology. Mm-hmm. They're conservative, they're liberal. They vote for Republicans or Democrats. They just don't want to be a part of the party. Is it time for a third major party? I don't know, but I do know these parties are going to have to start looking at the unaffiliated ranks a whole lot different, and it's not as moderate voters. They've got their work cut out for themselves, I think.
Right, and I always kind of see it in a way of saying the Republicans are pretty well established. They think they're going to get the Republican voters. The Democrats pretty well think they're going to get the Democrat voters, which I think is a little less true in North Carolina. The whole mommy was a Democrat, daddy was a Democrat, that sort of idea. But in general, and I feel like they're fighting over the unaffiliated votes. I feel like they're looking at your vote and my vote and going, how am I going to swing that vote to my side?
Right.
But it sounds like you're saying that there's a lot of people in the unaffiliated category that have very hard and fast beliefs and just refuse to be in the label, in the party.
I think that's it. And I think
whether it's for the freedom or whatever.
Right. I think that makes it even harder for the parties to figure out who's out there and what they're thinking and who are they going to vote for.
And that makes a tough time for them for sure.
Yes,
it sounds
it
like.
Yes, it does.
I need a lot of polling and stuff to try and make up that difference and figure out where the pulse is.
I have to keep coming back to Civitas every year in August for the unaffiliated poll, and then they'll know where they stand.
Oh yeah. So it's a big milestone, and it just really, again, hits me how it's not a ding against Republicans like you would think it was. Because when you first brought it to the show, my first thought was, Republicans are falling. I mean, are they going to have to get 10,000 signatures to get on a ballot? I mean, it's not a formal voting group. I mean, it's not, I guess, the Libertarian Party is overtaking the Republicans, in which case I think they would have to sign a petition to get on the ballot.
That's true.
But it's a voting block that really isn't a block, though, right? I mean, it's really not a unified block.
It's a voter registration block. But as far as categorizing voters, no, it's not a block at all.
So are they the great unknowns?
They're the great unknowns. Well, I do believe that.
I guess we're the great unknowns.
Yeah, and then the Democrats, and they're going to have to look to themselves and figure out why they're, as you put it, hemorrhaging voters.
I mean, what can they do in a way? I guess, I mean, I don't see the obvious way to come back against it. And granted, I'm not into the elections nearly as deeply as you are or many other people in the state, but I can't just point to one reason saying, like, what would it take for me, myself, to actually go through the effort of switching my voter registration? If I had registered as a Republican when I registered when I was turned 18, for me to say, I'm going to put in the effort to being unaffiliated would be a tough sell for me.
Yeah.
Or let's say, you know, I want to be
a
libertarian.
Most people do, though, Matt, especially if you're part. It's one thing to be a part of a party and be disaffected, and the next time you have to change your address, you go, well, while I'm doing this, I'm going to change my party, too.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. But to be an unaffiliated voter, to say, I want to be a Democrat now, why? Or I want to be a Republican now, why?
Because you want to be mailed more stuff.
Right.
You want more mailers. Although I'm not sure who gets more mailers, though? I get a lot of mailers. I get a lot of them. My wife is unaffiliated. She gets a lot of them, too.
I think it's the unaffiliated voters. Like you said, Republicans think they've got their base. Democrats think they've got their base. They've got their eyes set on that unaffiliated voter.
So can I join the Libertarian Party and no one sends me anything?
That may be it.
And I don't get anything, but I'm expected to vote for Sean Hall.
I think you've gotten to the point that everybody wanted to know. Become a Libertarian not to get.
To not get the mail. I mean, I was getting stuff from everyone. And then my wife was getting stuff from everyone. It was just stuffing our mailbox. And I think it probably is the unaffiliated.
It is.
That's because I believe my dad is a Republican. I think he is registered as that. And I just remember growing up in the election cycles, not nearly the amount of stuff.
No. Well, but I do believe that you've made the greatest point is that... the unaffiliated voter, you know, I'm not saying anybody's more important than the others, but to politicos and to people who run campaigns, that's who they're going to focus on.
Right. And I mean, it makes sense, though. If you think, you know, you've got one, you know, sale locked up, you're going to pay more attention to the unknown. You're going to pay more attention to developing the next lead and working to get the other sale. You're not going to beat a dead horse trying to convince a Republican to vote for a Republican.
Right.
Why would you?
That's exactly right. The only thing you're going to do there is try to get that vote to the polls. But other than that, you're going to concentrate on the voter you're not positive. You're not sure about that, but there's a possibility, and that would be the unaffiliated voter.
So does that in turn make campaigns more expensive?
I think so.
So
I
having
think it has to.
More mailers, more knocking on more doors, more face-to-face time, more... So, you know, internet reaching out through them and directed advertising. Yeah. I mean, it would have to make it more expensive to court the large mass that is the unaffiliated voters. I mean, what's the number of unaffiliated voters in the state right now?
It's 2 million. Hold on, Matt. It's just over 2 million because.
But that's a large chunk in a state of 10 million people.
There's close to 7 million people in North Carolina altogether, and
7 million voters?
7 million voters. Sorry about that. And I think it's 2 million, just over 2 million people are registered as Republicans, and 2 million people are registered as Democrats.
That's under 30%.
Unaffiliated. Yeah, just about 30% each.
That's a big chunk of people. And that's a big chunk of money trying to court the votes of those big chunk of people.
2,055,548 unaffiliated voters. 2,055,493 Republicans. Now, and that spread is just going to get bigger and bigger each week.
Right, because that's the trend. It's
that's right.
We knew it was inevitable that it was going to happen. It was just a question of when. Right. So it would say that Democrats are also on a trend of just still losing votes.
That's right. Republicans are gaining voters. But Democrats are losing. They're gaining. Republicans are gaining a few voters, but Democrats are losing voters.
So are they scared now? Are Democrats worried about this issue?
I don't have conversations with the Democrat Party, but I would think that they're concerned. I know I heard in the last month or two that they were working on a big voter registration effort. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it in the numbers at all. But that's what they did all throughout 2016. If you remember, there was a big push, and they said they had knocked on 80,000 doors, and they were going to And this is truly, 2016 was the first time that I ever saw in my life that Democrats didn't add voters in big numbers compared to Republicans. Republicans actually added more voters than Democrats. Shocking. Because usually Democrats will register tens of thousands of voters in the month or two leading up to the election. It didn't happen this time.
But thank you for coming on and bringing us an update on this and now having happened. You called it, it happened, and I guess we'll check back in 2020 and find out if the unaffiliates have taken over Democrats.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you to everyone who was on the show today. Thank you to you, the listeners. And if you're not already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you're doing that by searching for What Matters in North Carolina, where you listen to podcasts. Follow along with us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, by searching What Matters NC, and catch other episodes of the show or other shows on the Freedom Action Network at freedomactionnetwork.com. We'll catch you next time.